We'd like you to give us your opinion on some clothes for teenagers.
Oh, by all means, I'd be quite prepared for that eventuality.
Well, not your real opinion, naturally. It'll be written out and you'll learn it. Can you read?
Of course I can.
I mean lines, Ducky. Can you handle lines?
Well, I'll have a bash.
Good. Give him whatever it is they drink. A Coca-Rama?
A guitar?
Well, at least he's polite. Show him the shirts, Adrian. Now, you'll like these. You'll really dig them. They're fab and all the other pimply hyperboles.
I wouldn't be seen dead in them. The dead grotty.
Grotty?
Yeah, grotesque.
Make a note of that word and give it to Susan.
A clip from the 1964 film A Hard Day's Night. Ever wonder how suddenly teenagers decide that something, a band or huge low-hanging cargo pants or eyebrow piercing or one brand of high-top sneakers, is cool? In the new Frontline documentary, The Merchants of Cool, media analyst Douglas Rushkoff reports on the creators and sellers of popular culture, how cool hunters act as culture spies for corporations ferreting out trends, and the multi-layered strategies corporations use to corner the American teenage demographic, worth $150 billion a year. Rushkoff is the author of Coercion, Why We Listen to What They Say, and Playing the Future. The Merchants of Cool airs tonight on some PBS stations and on other PBS stations next week. In the Frontline piece, Douglas Rushkoff explores the methods marketing agencies use to sniff out possible teenage trendsetters. I asked him about a technique called under-the-radar marketing.
Well, that would be things like hiring incoming freshmen at a college to throw parties where they subtly hand out marketing material. So, you know, if you're a beer company, you might hire kids to have a beer party at their dorm room and then hand out little coasters or little beer glasses. Kids in their own environment being hired to sell things to one another. Or they'll hire a kid to be a spokesmodel for a product. And the kid might not really admit that they're a spokesmodel, although these days most would. They'll, you know, wear all the clothes or the sneakers from a new company. So they really end up being kind of a young walking billboard for a major company. The odd thing is, I thought, coming from where I was raised in the 70s, I thought most kids would really want to hide the fact that they're working for the company. You know, they'd want to hide the fact that the jackets they're wearing or the sneakers they've been given are part of some sponsorship deal and they're supposed to get other people to buy this. But it seems like most kids now are proud. You know, it's almost like instead of cool being the way it was when I was a kid, which was, oh, I'm cool because I resist the corporations, because I stand outside of my culture and I'm a rebel. Now, someone who's cool is someone who's been picked by the corporations to represent them. You know, the coolest thing for kids now is to get onto MTV or to get those free sneakers or to be invited to the Sprite.com launch party and paid $50, you know, to dance on MTV. So the way you get cool now is to be actually noticed by the corporation.
You went on an ethnographic research visit with MTV's market research guru, Todd Cunningham, to the house of an average Joe Schmo kid. What did he do there?
It was an entertaining experience for me. I really wonder how much they get from conducting an ethnographic study of that sort. It certainly cost them a lot of money. They do a lot of research to try to find a kid who is an average kid and basically nothing more than average. You know, he can't be too strange one way or another. And then they go out there, you know, with one or two of their anthropologists and a camera crew, and they, sit with the kid in the bedroom and they close the door and they ask them questions about, you know, his girlfriend and whether she sleeps over, and have the kid open his closet and show his favorite t-shirts. And then what they end up doing is taking all their tape back to MTV and they cut it together to look like an MTV video, because they figure all the executives at MTV have been raised on MTV. So the only really language in media they understand is MTV. So you end up with this sort of MTV video of all these little details from that kid's life. Then the idea is, if you see a say, a NASCAR flag on a average American teenager's wall in his bedroom, then they might use that as a set decoration on MTV's The Real World, which is supposed to look like a real place where these kids are living. And I asked him, the ethnographer there, I said, well, don't you think maybe the average kid that you're talking to now, maybe the decorations of the things that he puts up in his bedroom are coming from watching The Real World? And then you're putting, you're putting that stuff then on the new set of the next Real World. And he said, well, I guess it is kind of a feedback loop. And that really became the whole thrust of the documentary, which is that, in a sense, nobody is creating culture anymore. You know, kids are watching television, but television is watching the kids. And really all you end up with is this house of mirrors where there's no genuine culture being created anymore.
I'm speaking with media analyst Douglas Rushkoff. He's the author of Coercion, Why We Listen to What They Say, and Playing the Future. He reports on the tactics and the cultural ramifications of corporations marketing to teenagers in a new Frontline documentary, The Merchants of Cool. Douglas, we're going to take a short break now, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. We're back with media analyst Douglas Rushkoff. His new Frontline documentary, The Merchants of Cool, airs tonight on some PBS stations and next week on other PBS stations around the country. Haven't there always been teenagers who follow the curve, the stereotypes of popular culture? And, you know, back to the 50s again, they wore the DA hairstyle and the poodle skirts. And then there were always those kids who opt out, the iconoclasts and the weirdos and the individuals and the geeks or whatever label they get. I don't really see how this age of precision marketing and I think what you're calling cultural co-opting really changes that equation.
Well, for me, for one, it would be depressing to think that youth culture has not developed in the past 51 years. You know, if we are where we were in the 50s, then that's too bad because it means that we haven't even developed since the 50s. It seemed to me by the 60s and the 70s, you know, teen culture and rock and roll and music culture were places where some culturally progressive ideas were actually emerging. And it seems to me that not only have we regressed to a place where genuine ideas really can't emerge from mainstream music culture, but that rebellion itself, you know, the indie culture you're speaking of itself, has been really wrestled to the ground. You know, that now where it used to be the way to be cool was to stand apart from the corporate monolith, was to look at this mainstream rock and roll machine and say, ah, we see what that is, but the truly cool stuff comes from underground. The truly cool stuff comes from kids. It might get co-opted eventually, but at least it's being generated from something that is real, from something that is authentic. And now it seems to me there's much, much less space for that kind of thing to happen. You know, the most genuine thing going on in music today is probably Napster, which is really just a way for consumers to share programs for free. But it's very hard for any youth cultural movement to develop for more than a week or two without being scooped up and sold back to them at the mall. And it's really that the process is much, much faster right now than it used to be.
So that's the insidiousness of the feedback loop that even when kids think they're rebelling, they're not. They're just rebelling in the way the market tells them to. Is that the message you read in the popularity, say, of rage rock bands like Limp Bizkit?
Well, right. Rage rock, you know, this music that in theory originally came out of Detroit, which was rebellion against MTV, really. It was rebellion against MTV culture, is now MTV culture's hottest and most money-making thing. You know, it's as if... You know, it's not as if it is that the rebellion itself ends up just energizing the machine. The coolest thing to say on MTV is that MTV sucks, you know, and MTV will grab that because if someone is saying MTV sucks, then that must be authentic. You know, MTV will do documentaries about Woodstock 99 where they show how, you know, kids rioted and how four girls got raped at Woodstock 99, you know, the day after Limp Bizkit played and was generally credited or blamed for creating this hoopla. And although MTV can go, oh, this is a terrible thing, at the same time, MTV uses the crime, uses the rape as evidence that they had an authentic event. In other words, at least if you are at Woodstock 99, you are at something real, something tragic, something authentic. And it really earns them points as authentic culture.
You used to be a consultant of sorts to companies who wanted to understand better what was driving youth culture. You talked to executives, and corporations executives read your 1994 book, Media Virus, as almost a primer in how to market to teenagers. Do you regret that period in your life, given what we're talking about now? You feel you participated in the feedback loop?
I don't know if it's possible not to participate in a feedback loop in some way. I mean, in the early 90s, I was very encouraged by youth culture's resistance to marketing. And I looked at shows like, you know, The Simpsons or even Pee Wee Herman or grunge rock and Nirvana and that media cynicism as a sign that kids were too smart to be taken in, that, you know, the sort of the corporate control over media was really going to fade now. Kids weren't going to fall for advertising. They weren't going to fall for this stuff anymore. And we would get a more interesting, empowered, and media literate culture as a result. And I wrote books really about that. That's what Media Virus was about, this changing face of media and how smart people are getting, especially young people. And the book ended up being used as a primer by corporate America in how to retool their arsenal for a newly media literate youth culture. So it's hard for me to say, oh, I regret writing this book. No, you know, I don't regret it. I regret my own naivete. I regret not having, you know, the cynicism to realize that these hopeful moments of intelligence are windows of opportunity and not done deals, and that what we have to do when those moments arise is use them, you know, is capitalize on them, seize upon them to extend media literacy rather than just, you know, celebrate it and move on.
Douglas Rushkoff, his report, The Merchants of Cool, a frontline documentary, airs tonight on some PBS stations and next week on others across the country.